Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me to talk today. I'm a consultant psychiatrist, and when I was a medical student and a junior doctor, I don't think I ever heard anybody that was training me mention domestic violence at all. And yet, as you sit through lots of clinics and have lots of acute inpatient work, sometimes you wonder if anybody that you see actually hasn't experienced domestic violence, either as a child witnessing it or being abused themselves, or as an adult. And you start to get a very distorted perspective in the world and wonder why everybody else around you doesn't. So that's actually how I started to think about this. And my patients and my research participants all were also telling me that this was something I needed to be focusing on. I never intended to actually carry out research into domestic violence and mental health, but I ended up having no alternative, I felt. So if we actually think about the current definition of domestic violence, actually all types of violence, of domestic violence and abuse, are linked to an impact on mental health. So what I'm going to talk about is the significance of this link and what health services, particularly mental health services, can do about it. Now, often when I talk to health professionals, somebody in the audience says, but this isn't really a healthcare issue, is it? It's actually a social problem. So I have to remind them, and I probably don't need to remind you, that women who've experienced violence often seek healthcare, partly because they have injuries, whether they're physical or mental. And even though they might not disclose the abuse or violence, we are clearly seeing them, and actually we're somebody that people might trust and actually want to talk to about it. So we also know, actually, that abused women, of course, use health services more than non-abused women, and actually that costs the NHS a lot of money. And Sylvia Wolby, in 2009, published an update of her previous work talking about the cost to the NHS of more than £1,700 million. So this shows you the prevalence of an incident or more than one incident in the previous 12 months of people presenting to different parts of the healthcare service. Now, the light blue is the general population. So, and this is the women who are in the general population in the British Crime Survey. Around 5% will say they experienced an incident in the previous 12 months. Whereas if you actually look at antenatal care, there's higher, which is in green, you'll see higher experiences that are disclosed. And if you look at accident and emergency, up to 40% of women will have experienced an incident of domestic violence in the previous year, even if they're not actually presenting with an injury of domestic violence at that time. And a colleague in Southwest London asked his female community mental health team patients what had happened to them in the last year, and 15% of them said they'd experienced physical violence. Now, when you're thinking about domestic violence and the link with mental health problems, there are actually a number of research issues that one needs to remember. So there's the research done, for example, by the British Crime Survey looking at isolated incidents of domestic violence. But then actually there is also the other area of research, which is looking at impact and about repeated and coercive and severe abuse. And one does need to work out which one's talking about in different studies. Also, as a psychiatrist, I know that my colleagues get very worked up about whether somebody's actually got a clinical disorder that warrants their input or not. So we need to also disentangle whether somebody's actually got a clinical disorder or whether it's just symptoms. And I'm not saying that symptoms aren't important, but in terms of who the health service is going to be seeing, we're going to be seeing people with disorder. And then if you're trying to disentangle the impact, obviously, cross-sectional studies aren't going to be enough. You need to actually look at what happens over time. Finally, unfortunately, most of the research still focuses on partner violence that is physical, rather than also thinking about the other types of violence, including emotional psychological abuse, which a lot of people talk about as actually that having the greatest impact on their mental health. And most of the research also focuses on women that are victims, but I have some very vulnerable patients who are men, who have men with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, who we know are actually at greatly increased risk of being a victim of violence in general, and there's very little research on their experience of also being abused within their families. So what we did was a systematic review of the international literature looking at people with a diagnosis of disorders and the likelihood that they had experience domestic violence as adults. This shows you our meta-analysis, which is a pooling of all the relevant studies to get an overall idea of the risk of having experienced domestic violence. And this is physical violence, because that's what's mainly out there in the literature. And it shows that if you've got depression, then you are three times more likely than other women to have experienced domestic violence as an adult. If you've got an anxiety disorder, you've got actually a slightly higher risk of having experienced domestic violence. And if you've got post-traumatic stress disorder, then not surprisingly, even higher. There are some studies on schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but very few. So we can't do these nice little graphs for those. But they do also show that women with those disorders are at increased risk. We've also looked at the Adult Psychiatric Morbidity Survey data, and I know you can't see this, but just to prove that I'm not just making the figures up, this shows you that actually it's not just the common mental disorders of depression, anxiety and PTSD, it's also eating disorders, substance misuse and even psychosis, that this data shows for not only physical violence but also emotional abuse, there is an association. Finally, things can start very early, and we've looked at the ALSPAC cohort, which is a group of women that were recruited in pregnancy in the early 90s in the Avon area, which, of course, you all know is a very nice area of the UK. But nevertheless, at 18 weeks gestation, when women were asked if they were experiencing emotional or physical cruelty, now, actually, the questions they were asked were really not great questions, but this was the early 90s. People didn't know how to ask about domestic violence, particularly in research. But nevertheless, they did get disclosures of 6% of pregnant women saying that they had experienced emotional cruelty for their partner, 2% physical, and 7% reporting either. And not surprisingly, there was a high correlation between antenatal violence and subsequent postnatal violence. And we found that antenatal violence was associated with antenatal depression, with postnatal depression, but also, most alarmingly, it was also associated with behaviour problems in the child at 42 months of age. If you're thinking about the pregnancy period, when a woman might be abused, then you may know that there are a whole host of hypotheses around the environment for the fetus being terribly important, and that it needs to be optimal in terms of nutrition and also other factors such as stress hormones. And there's a professor in Southampton who's done a huge amount of work showing that a suboptimal fetal environment is associated with later onset disease. Now, he focused on cardiovascular disease, but actually there's also a whole body of literature which shows that prenatal anxiety or stress is associated with adverse cognitive and behavioural outcomes, independent of postnatal stress. So what happens in pregnancy is important. And we think that's because there's an increase in stress hormones, cortisol, in the mother, which increases the exposure for the fetus to cortisol, and that then affects the expression of many of the genes in the fetal brain cells. This isn't irreversible, because actually if the infant is then able to experience a good attachment with the mother, then the adverse outcomes can be ameliorated. On the other hand, if the child is then abused, then those epigenetic phenomena that happen in utero are worsened, and the outcomes for the children in terms of psychological health are worse. And of course, we also know that in those families where there is domestic violence happening, that actually a lot of those children are witnessing it if they're not being directly abused themselves. And the NHS Task Force estimated that more than 750,000 children are witnessing domestic violence in England each year. So coming back to the main part of my talk, domestic violence and mental health, is the association causal, people often ask. Well, we certainly know that severity of abuse is associated with severity of symptoms, and that symptoms do decrease when the abuse stops. We also know that there's a few, not very many studies, but there are some large prospective studies which show that women who are experiencing abuse do then go on to develop subsequent psychiatric morbidity problems. We also know that if you have a pre-existing mental health problem, then you are more likely to experience domestic violence. So it does seem that there's a bi-directional association there. Finally, we also know, actually, that women who experience domestic violence are actually less likely to access mental health care, because they're often prevented from doing so, whereas for serious physical injuries, they will usually end up having seeking physical services, whereas for mental health services, they might not actually get there. But if we look at the people in contact with mental health services, and I'm talking about secondary care now, not mental health services within primary care, Then for our female inpatients, we found from high-quality papers that a median prevalence of a third had experienced domestic violence as an adult. Female outpatients, it was over 40%. We only found one high-quality study for our male patients, but 18% of inpatients had experienced domestic violence as an adult, and 4%, just over 4% for outpatients. But what was most striking from this review was that clinicians were not picking this up. They were only detecting around 10 to 30% of the experiences of domestic violence that when researchers went in, the patients were telling them. So there's been a lot of talk about whether health services should routinely inquire. And the Department of Health policy is that maternity and mental health services should be routinely asking about domestic violence. Now, that might be policy, but I can assure you that is not what's happening on the ground. Nevertheless, our Mental Health Trust service users certainly say that they're not going to disclose frequently unless they're asked. And we've done some qualitative research with local service users, and they've told us about some of the reasons why they might not disclose. In fact, we then mapped out their qualitative data into a series of themes, which has been published last year, if you're interested in reading about this. And one of the main themes that came out from this data was that they are really scared. They're very scared of the consequences of disclosure to a professional because they're worried that it might result in further violence if the perpetrator finds out. They're worried about the involvement of statutory services, particularly in South East London, where there's a lot of people very worried about immigration, but also about social care. Are they going to be blamed for not protecting the children? They're also very worried that they won't be believed, and many of them told us they hadn't been believed. And there's a whole host of other themes which I haven't got time to talk about now, but I also wanted to talk about the professionals' views, because we also asked the professionals why they might not ask and what were their barriers to asking. And I'm sure you know this already, but many of them felt that they felt very uncomfortable about asking for a variety of reasons, but often because they didn't know what on earth to do with the information. So what we then thought about was, well, we were all taught that we should be asking, but what training is actually going on? And if you look at the primary care literature, in primary care now, there has been a really very impressive cluster RCT done by a colleague called Jean Fader in Bristol, where the general practices were trained, not just the GPs, but the nurses, the reception staff. They were all trained to be much more aware of domestic violence, to be asking whether they had any suspicion, for example, if a woman came in with depression or other indicators. So they weren't focusing on routine inquiry, but clinical inquiry is what they call it in primary care. And they then also had a linked domestic violence advisor who they could refer to. And what this graph shows is that there was a dramatic increase in the number of women identified to be experiencing domestic violence and also the proportion of referrals to the domestic violence sector. So we've aimed to replicate this in a pilot recently in our local community mental health teams. And what we wanted to do was to actually reciprocally train in terms of domestic violence, have the domestic violence sector come into our teams and do some training rather than it being offered out there, which meant that the professionals were never getting to it. And also that we could offer training because our advisors sometimes felt quite anxious about helping women with schizophrenia or with bipolar disorder, so that we would do some reciprocal training and that we would have named people who the community team got to know and could make a referral to. And what this pilot showed, and this is a small pilot, but we did find improvements in quality of life and social inclusion in our service users that were obtaining the intervention, and also a reduction in the number of health and social care needs. And we actually also measured the knowledge and attitudes and practices of the professionals 6 months after the training and found that they were still sustained compared with the control teams that didn't receive the training at the time, although we subsequently offered it to them. So to conclude, my patients do have an increased prevalence of having experienced domestic violence. They experience significant barriers to disclosure of domestic violence, but these barriers of the professionals not asking are very similar to those reported in other healthcare settings. We know that their knowledge and also their practice isn't optimal. So we really need to still focus on training, I'm afraid. We still need to be training these mental health professionals on safe assessment and treatment. And we do have a new president who's very committed to this agenda at the Royal College of Psychiatrists, which is great. We also need to integrate interventions and work in partnership with domestic violence services so that we can all learn from each other. And we hope that that will be effective in improving outcomes. And finally, just so that you know, the World Health Organization are about to publish guidelines on the healthcare response to violence against women and girls, and this will be coming out in August. And of course, as Davina's already mentioned, the NICE guidelines are just starting to be prepared. Thank you very much. I just wanted to acknowledge my funders, National Institute for Health Research, the South London Maudsley Trustees, and my collaborators. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.